Zach Stevens Podcast. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Zach Stevens Podcast. I'm welcomed by the best number one guest I could ask for and exactly who I wanted on the bill, Mr. Matt Stock. How are you, Matt?
What's up, Stevens? How's it going?
Oh, it's going. How was dinner tonight?
Dinner was good. Before we talk about dinner, I just want to say, tremendously honored to be the inaugural guest on the podcast. But like, in the interest of full disclosure, I did also tell you, like, I'm kind of going to be pissed off at you if I'm not the first guest. Like,
yeah, there was a little bit of, there was backlash to be faced.
I heard some other names thrown out there. You're like, well, maybe so-and-so or maybe so-and-so, but or you would be cool. I'm like, yeah, it's going to be me.
Yeah, there was no question at the end of the day because I'm the smaller man here.
I strong-armed you into being the debut, but I'm going to do a good job. We're going to have a good first episode. Congratulations. I'm excited about the project, man.
Yeah, this is awesome stuff. I'm excited, and it seriously couldn't have been anyone else. Like, the main vision is to have a ton of local musicians on here and talk about their lives and what they're doing in the scene here and, you know, just anything else that they want to talk about, really. But I was like, Matt's not a musician, but he is the man of the people. And he's like the godfather of us musicians.
I'm a hipster doofus. So people would say I'm like a hanger-on. I hang around the musicians, you know. But, and I mean, I work with so many musicians, you know, John Cranford, of course, first and foremost, with all our projects, but... I've always been a fan of local music since I moved here. It's coming up on 13 years now. But once I started booking at Charbar, like once Nick Burgett let me get more involved with when we kicked off the Saturday Night Concert Series.
Oh, man.
Which was like successful for many
and
years.
And I told you the other day, those were some of my favorites that I've ever... I can remember to a T walking up on a summer concert series on a Saturday at Charbar, and it was pretty darn playing, and yeah. I was like, these guys are perfect for the sound. There's so many beautiful women around.
It's
the
crazy,
ambiance.
Man.
Those were perfect.
I think the first ones were so separated from that now, but you know, Nick and Kyle started working out the project at Charbar, and it was great. It was like honored to have them, you know, and knew they were great, but didn't know how far it was going to advance, or like then they put out these great albums. You know, they did album release parties there, and those shows had a vibe, and people still talk about them.
I opened for one of those.
Yeah.
That was one of my first ever solo gigs. Well, one thing I don't think is brought up enough is like, you know, where you start in something that eventually becomes your career.
Yeah.
And I got to thank you for like day one. You were the first person to take a chance on me to play Charbar.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's first solo gig and I loved it. And also thank you, Nick and Andrea Burgell, who won't listen to this, but.
Shout out nonetheless.
Yeah.
But no, they were supportive. They were very supportive of local music. I mean, year round, 7 nights a week. Which all came to immediate screeching halt as soon as the Surge Group acquired Charbar. But, you know, I was happy with what they did there. And, you know, Surge supports local musicians in other ways. But, those shows, and I think it was cool how I met you was sort of through those shows because you did open. I was like, Stevens, just put an hour together. You think you can put an hour together? I want you to open for
this
pretty
is the hardest hour of my life.
and it was a tremendous success right from the bat, not surprisingly. But I met you through your band Native.
Yep.
Who... the story that I like to tell about Native is, at the time, Grayson and Davis, your bandmates, their mom, Erin, was doing your sort of managing / booking. And she was aggressively trying to book Native for one of the Saturday night shows.
Oh, was she?
And I was just, yeah, imagine that, right? Hi, Erin. I know Erin will listen to this.
Hey, Erin.
And she was, and I was just like, you know, I have to admit, I was a little cynical about it because I knew that you guys were like 14 or 15 years old at the time. And I was like, I'm sure that, you know, they have a good thing going, but I'm just like, they're too young. It's not going to happen. And then probably about a month later, I saw you guys open for Groovetown Assault when they had that big record release party.
Oh, the Boardroom
record. At the Boardroom with the elevated stage.
Yeah, that was fun. We played like Creep.
Great night.
Not a Radiohead guy.
But I walked up, you know, and I think I've told this story a couple other times in media and stuff, but I heard approaching this band. I'm like, this sounds great. I don't know who it is, you know? Mm-hmm. So I get there, but I'm walking in the Boardroom, I'm like, who is this? It's playing right now. Some guy's like, Native. And I was like, the kids? And within 5 minutes, I knew I was wrong. I was like, I was fucking stupid. And like, I contacted Erin immediately and was like, I'm sorry. You were right. Could I please, you know, get Native to perform?
You know who else was there that night? It was the first time I ever saw this guy. He was the first band or first duo on the bill that night. It was Yanni.
For real?
And Peter B.
Oh yeah,
they were. I don't think they were opening for GTA. I think they were playing the Boardroom.
Yeah,
but I remember seeing Yanni for the first time, and I was like, "Holy shit, who was that?"
But no, it was awesome, and I became a huge fan of Native immediately, and still, and remain so to this day.
Yeah, you know, those are fun shows. Great guys. I love every one of them. I still play with most of them in a facet. Nate plays with everyone. Yeah. But
I reunited you guys last summer.
You did. That was such a fun show. Crazy.
That took some work. Crazy, crazy I'm going to tell you people, like, getting Native together is like, guys, like chasing fucking chickens around a yard.
Yeah, shout out Mia Huey for that one.
It takes a lot. It takes a lot of persuasion, but I think when they get together, they really enjoy themselves. I'm sorry, that's very unprofessional.
We have our first phone ring of the podcast on the very first one. We had to get it out of the way sometime. You know?
Yeah, that didn't take too long, right?
Who cares? Who cares?
My apologies. But yeah, so, but coming, I guess, coming back around the block, my involvement with the musicians basically grew exponentially from booking at Charbar.
Oh, yeah.
And once the program became more successful, their avenues opened to other musicians that were skeptical at first, or, you know, it's a new thing coming up, so... you have a limited budget and whatnot, but the more we succeeded, the more we were able to afford. And it was a good few years.
Those summer concert series only felt like up.
People
like,
still talk about them.
Yeah.
You know, and I think so that's fun. And they were special nights. It was,
you know, I think this word is funny, but like ambiance. When you think of it in like a restaurant, you think of like, oh, I feel good. Like that was a true ambiance.
Yeah, just the way the courtyard was lit, it just really lent itself for even the shape.
You had
like
a fire going.
A small natural amphitheater or something like that.
You have some of the best harmonies on Hilton Head, too.
I mean, those pretty darn shows were ridiculous.
That was like the perfect fit, was them. So, yeah, you can't beat that.
Yeah, but, I'm very proud of those.
So take me back a little bit. Like, clearly you've had this love for music forever.
Yeah.
And like, where does that start?
There's two like... two basics to it started with. My parents were big music fans, mostly like rock, but a lot of some Motown stuff like that. They had a great record collection. And like I told you earlier, I would just sit, I'd take all the records out of the cabinet, sit Indian style on the floor. So this is very young, and just put them all around me.
What are you thinking here? Like 6, 7?
Yeah, sure. And I'd pick out stuff that I thought had an interesting looking cover, or, you know, some of them I knew, just I knew songs that I liked. But,
that's awesome.
You know, the radio was still huge back then, so every time we're in the car, I'm listening to these great rock stations in Philly, 93.3 WMMR, 94 WYSP. Like,
if you had to imagine in your head right now, like a song that your dad or mom would be humming to, like what would it be?
My dad used to like the Heart of Rock and Roll by Huey Lewis and the News.
Okay.
And whenever it would come on, he would like air drum and stuff, and drive with his knees, and it would drive me into like a fucking panic. But that's one that sticks out. And he wasn't like a big Huey Lewis fan, but that comes to mind. And I remember driving around like during the holidays and visiting family, and always hearing like Bruce, Santa Claus is coming to town. But they liked the Beatles a lot. They liked Zeppelin. They liked Steely Dan.
Yeah.
They liked the Steve Miller Band.
Absolutely. Which you love.
It was like my first favorite album cover. Okay, here's some secrets revealed.
We're learning some truths here.
I'm a known basher of the Steve Miller Band. People think it's like a bit. It's really not. I really do think they're a terrible band. But their album, Book of Dreams, had this Pegasus on the cover. And as a 6, 7-year-old kid, I thought it was the coolest thing in the world.
Oh, yeah, with like the kind of crest thing around
it,
too.
Yeah, and I think Jet Airliner's the first track on that album.
And said that's a good song.
It is a good song.
Yeah.
I still like that, but that's it. There's an exception to every rule, but Frampton Comes Alive. I had a cool uncle.
Oh my gosh.
My mom's brother Gene gave me some Kiss albums.
Yeah, and you said that they were like superheroes.
Yeah, and so I thought that they were awesome. They had this album that came out in 1980 called Dynasty, which is their best selling album, I think, still to this day, and had their highest charting single was a song called I Was Made for Loving You. Okay. And it is very much a disco song. Disco-influenced. At the time, though, that's what's selling records, right? I mean, the shit the Stones did it with, like, Some Girls. Yeah. Songs like Miss You and Shattered. But so the Kiss Army, my uncle was, like, cooler, way into Kiss. They all, like, disavowed Kiss for putting out a disco song. So he was like, I don't want this album. You can have it. And the cover was their four faces, like, in a square.
I remember that one.
And it's a great album.
It's kind of like Night at the Opera, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, the Night at the Opera, that's probably, like, Love Gun or they're, like, painted... You know, the Dynasty was like their photos, like four of them. They have all great covers.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. I see what you're saying.
So I ended up getting, and my parents got some Kiss albums. So Kiss was a big one. So that's the first part of it, parental influence.
That's funny that you say that you would get a little nervous in the car with your dad driving, listening to Huey Lewis in the News. When I was coming up, I would ride around with my brother's dad, and he had this thing about Purple Rain. And that was like.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, I know, who doesn't? But he would just drive like a lunatic to Purple Rain, especially at the end during the guitar solo, and I couldn't care less about music, but I was like, this guy's cool, talking about Prince. You know? But,
of course.
Continue. I'd love to.
Okay, so the second thing, MTV, hands down. Yeah, I want to say 1980 or 1981. the debut of MTV? Like, you can look that up, but I can say this with complete confidence. From the moment MTV premiered, I was, God, say I was like 7-ish years old. Mm-hmm. My sister and I watched it on a continuous loop for about 10 years. Like, we loved MTV. And this was during, it was all video era. The MTV's, it was an all rock format for the most part in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it was basically, the videos were like, you know, publicity shoots that the record labels did for some like TV shows and shit like that. The music video form itself obviously became an entire different genre. Like, it was a revolution.
What was the first big video to hit MTV? Like game changer. Was it Michael Jackson?
Well, Thriller and Billie Jean. But before that, I remember like Rod Stewart was on a lot. Bowie was a big one, and he had very strange videos like Ashes to Ashes, Boys Keep Swinging, like Fashion. They were very arty. Some were kind of scary, some were creepy, but I was really transfixed on this stuff.
Talk to me about some Bowie stuff that might be happening in your life.
Oh, Bowie. Well, you know, today is the 5-year anniversary of David Bowie's passing.
Yep.
Passed away 2 days after his birthday 5 years ago. Well, simultaneously releasing an album that's basically about his death.
Yeah, yeah.
Black Star.
That there's a song in there called Lazarus.
Yes.
Lazarus?
Yeah.
Yeah. That
he released a video and died the next day. It's a song about him dying. He released it and he died the next day.
Only Bowie could do that.
Only he could. And I've always loved Bowie. I like that he I like performance art. You know, it's like the Kiss thing, you know, and he said so many like the thin white Duke Ziggy Stardust, he's had all these personas.
Maybe that's why Rocky, you know, is your thing.
He always, like Rocky Horror and stuff like that, but he always did reinvent himself, and the music is always great, which of course matters at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's the...
But
that's
I think Bowie's the coolest artist of all time.
Yeah, so he had a big thing on MTV?
He was huge on MTV, and he's also the first... he was doing an interview with Mark Goodman, one of the first MTV VJs, put him right on the spot about not playing any black music.
Oh, wow.
Which has kind of became a famous interview. He's like, you guys don't feature any, why didn't you feature any soul music or R&B music? And so it was like a reverse ambush question. Mark Goodman's like, oh, well, you know, it's like stammering and shit. But I think one thing a lot of people don't know is that
is there a live video of that somewhere?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. You can see it. Well, one thing that people don't know, I've read in several accounts of, is that like Quincy Jones and like CBS Records had to push Michael Jackson.
What?
To MTV, like, yeah, I mean, they would occasionally show some clips from Off the Wall, like Rock With You. He had a video for that I would see pop up here and there, but, like, so Billie Jean was the first single, obviously now an iconic video. And there was like, MTV was hesitant to do so. Now they'll say, like, oh, Michael Jackson, he won, like, the King of Pop, they called him the King of Pop.
Yeah, the King
they
of
gave
Pop.
Him all these awards, you know, like the original video of Vanguard. But they had to have their arm twisted to do it, like, Quincy Jones had to step in and, like, pull a power play. And then, of course, it was Billie Jean.
Thank God for Quincy Jones.
And then it was Beat It. And then it was Thriller, which was still like the biggest video of all time. It scared the shit out of me.
Did you know, and I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure Quincy Jones' first big like task as a producer was to produce Frank Sinatra.
Is that so?
I think so.
He's prolific.
I think he had a couple, helped Frank out with a couple things.
I was telling your roommate and our friend Matt Robbins the other day.
Shout out Matt Robbins.
He played some Toto at the lounge on the jukebox.
Oh, Rosanna?
Yeah. Amazing song, right? And I told Matt, I just recently learned from some video that I watched on YouTube that Steve Lukather and a couple other guys from Toto.
They were his band.
Did Toto.
They
played, they were the band on Thriller.
Yeah, that bad lyric, that bad riff, right? Is it Bad or is it Beat It?
Beat It. Yeah. Now, Eddie Van Halen plays a solo in Beat It.
So they just had Murder's Row.
But yeah, so I mean, that's, you know... So that was a very cool collaboration. But Toto, who's I think a very cool band, even somewhat underrated.
Oh my gosh, we could spend an hour talking about
that. Oh yeah, Toto. But the MTV was, you know, it was so cool to watch all those videos, and that's where and it's also, I think, contributed to my love for film, for the visual medium.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
But I was always a movie kid too. I'm a pop culture fanatic.
I was about to say, like, that your love for pop culture, I think, rubs off on people.
Well, I think that there's just some cool stuff about it. I mean, there's just movies, comic books, books, music.
Well, one thing I love about you is like you're always sort of a breath of fresh air. Like you can go on Facebook and you'll be like, oh, like one lady's like, my dog is missing, and one lady's like, that's Antifa in the Capitol, and then and then you're like, here's a picture of Blondie, Debbie Harry. You know,
yeah, I like fan art and shit like that. I love that, like, paintings and stuff like that. Yeah, and Blondie, of course.
A lot of that stuff reminds me of I went through a Warhol exhibit one time.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, this is fun. Like, this is just, it's just good. It's like eye candy. You know?
I like the, you know, I like the mediums themselves. I enjoy them for what they are. Yeah. But then as I get older, they trigger, it's like a sense memory thing. And there's a nostalgia factor that like, okay, I can hear this song and be like, man, this song is dope. Or I can hear the song and be like, this is the first song I ever slow danced to. You know, when I was like 12, or this song, oh my God, I remember we used to drive around in my Camaro and raise hell and race and, you know, listen to this Aerosmith album. Movies like I saw this. I remember I went on a date and saw this movie with my sweetie and whatever happened, like, you know.
Yeah.
And all, there's so many like fond memories that come from it.
Yeah, you can tie songs and things of pop culture of that nature to very distinctive memories in your life.
It's like, the best way I've ever seen that displayed in pop culture form. I don't know if you're familiar with High Fidelity, the movie High Fidelity.
I know the name. Who directed it?
Stephen Frears directed it. It's a John Cusack movie.
Okay.
Where he owns a record store, and it's like him and Jack Black, and they're total rock snobs, and it's all very.
Why haven't I seen this movie?
We're probably gonna watch it tonight.
All right.
But he has a record collection, obviously, and he's got a record store called Championship Vinyl. Great.
Okay.
Great name for a record store. And they basically sit around the record store and they talk about their all-time top fives. All-time top five side one, track ones. All-time top five this or that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it was a scene where he's going through a bad breakup, so he's rearranging his records. Buddy comes over and says, what are you doing? I said, I'm rearranging my record collection. And he says, well, not alphabetically, obviously. And he says, no, I'm organizing them autobiographically.
Oh, he's okay.
Like, so if I want to hear Landslide by Fleetwood Mac, I can't go to letter F. I have to think about the time that so-and-so girl hurt my feelings in seventh grade.
That's wild.
To that, you know, moment.
Yeah,
and so, his friend says, that sounds very comforting. And I agree. I think it does sound comforting.
So I was going to ask you, like, I mean, I think this happens to everyone, so it's not going to be random that it happens to you. But, like, how, like, do you go through phases with your music taste?
Yes.
And how does that play out for you?
We sort of grab onto something and...
Like, what's right now? Like, what's your thing?
Right now?
Yeah.
What am I going heavy with right now? Depeche Mode.
Oh, yeah.
Always the Stones to an extent. Like I told you last night, I got drunk and I was a little sad and I listened to a bunch of sad music.
Yeah.
I listened to Whitney Houston, Didn't We Almost Have It All?
That's
one of
the
greatest
sad
ballads of all time. Dionne Warwick, her aunt, I Know I'll Never Love This Way Again.
Wow.
Like, yeah, I'll sit there with the ear pods in and just sort of, you know, have just a little moment.
Just feel it out.
But what happened is it's YouTube. And now, like, you know, Spotify,
yeah,
and apps like
right
that,
there.
Like YouTube will put you there. It's the algorithm is great.
It's
just
amazing.
You know, you just go through the suggested videos and the leaps that you can make.
Dude, the playlist, and I know as a musician and any of my friends that produce and make music that are listening to this, I'm sorry if you're like a big Spotify hater. I get it, but Spotify is so user friendly, and the playlist that they make for you,
yeah,
they
get five daily mixes.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. Here lately, this playlist has been playing. You were listening to it today with me. It's got like Jim Croce,
oh,
you know, Loggins and Messina, Doobie Brothers, Steely
Little
Dan,
River Band,
LRB.
It was hardcore AM gold, which I love. That's a genre of music that I always enjoy and always listen to.
I
like disco a lot too.
Is it yacht
to a
rock?
Lot of disco.
Is it
yacht rock? Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But classic rock's the backbone of my, like, you know, at the end of the day, the Stones are everything to me, and Bowie, The Clash, Steely Dan.
Bob Seger.
Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band.
Don't leave that
like
guy
stuff
out.
Like that. I love it. I love rock and roll.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
So that's funny that you have, like, all these awesome slow dancing memories or movie memories to songs like that. Like, mine was 6'7" by Lil Wayne. That was like my first kiss.
Oh,
and
really?
And then it was like The Motto by Drake.
So romantic.
And
it wasn't
like what I wanted.
Hey, man, it's generational, you know? Like, yeah. The first song I ever slow danced to was The Living Years by Mike and the Mechanics.
I don't think you'll know, but
some of your listeners will for sure. It's Mike Rutherford's band. He's the guitarist in Genesis.
Okay.
And that was his side project.
You know, I'm always down.
They had a big
to
hit
it.
Album, yeah. So, and that's, you know.
Like, I feel like if I could go back and rewrite every moment of, like, my first, like, kiss or slow dance, like, I would want to hear, like, I don't want to lose you. Like, I would want to hear,
oh, yeah,
I would
sure
want to hear something like that, not, like,
I love 80s music. I think there's a pop sensibility to it and a listenability factor.
Yeah.
And a fun factor that,
oh my gosh,
that still holds up, you know.
That does. Well, that's songs why shows like Stranger Things stick so hard.
Yeah, songs like that shit that still lands with people, you know, and it resonates with people that are my age because of the nostalgia factor, but with people from your generation, you just hear it and you're like, yeah, I think you have a good ear. Like, at the end of the day, it's like, look, what makes my heart beat? What makes my toes tap? what makes you want to dance with a girl.
Exactly. What makes you feel,
what's
really
fun. Yes. Yeah. So it doesn't give a shit if, like, you know, yeah, I like a couple of Britney Spears songs, you know, or, you know, or this or that.
You know what I like? I like when Britney Spears winks 15 times in a video, so we'll save her.
Oh, yeah. I'm always decoding the messages, but that's a podcast for another time. This isn't a four-hour episode, so.
We'll have our own Save Britney podcast.
But I love music, and I love film, and it's just, it gives me tremendous joy. Like, I enjoy all the art forms, and I like to share it with people, because it's like, oh, it's cool to share something, you know.
Yeah, and you've really taken the medium of writing to a new level on Hilton Head 2, talking about musicians.
Yeah.
I mean, these Southender articles hit home, especially.
Well, that's also a credit to my parents, who I think got me a subscription to Rolling Stone for Christmas when I was probably like 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And I grew up reading Rolling Stone voraciously. It came every 2 weeks in the mail.
That's awesome.
I'd read it over and over. I'd cut every cover off and put it on my bedroom wall. My bedroom wall was hundreds of Rolling Stone
covers. Do you still have any of those or no?
No.
Where'd they go?
I took them down and replaced them with comic books at some point.
That's better.
Hung comic books up. Yeah. So I just know, just levels upon levels of nerdiness. But so I've always enjoyed music journalism. And I studied writing, you know. I focused on writing my entire education.
So
from as young as I can remember, and then into college as well.
Yeah. And I mean, it shows, because I think people respect your opinion as well. Like, when you do a critique on something, you have a big comment thread, and people are always like, you know, is this how I feel about this now?
I like it. I enjoy writing criticism. It's one of my favorite things to write, whether it's a movie or a record. I mean, it's locally. You don't want to bash local artists. I mean, it's like I was joking about with you. Look, I'm not an actor. I'm not a musician. I don't do those things, but I do love it, and I like to write about it. And
yeah, no doubt.
It's so I think I can speak on it with authority and like some understanding. But there are so many talented people.
Yeah, like I don't believe in that whole thing. Like you shouldn't be able to speculate because you don't participate.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people are really, really, really educated on some things. They just don't really have maybe the time, or like, you know, I hate to say this, but like some people don't have the talent to sit down and just guitar is something that comes naturally, you know, or music in that sense.
But,
and
my criticisms are mostly based on appreciation. Like, I think about all the movie reviews I've written over the years. Like, usually if I think a movie's shit, or if I watch something, I'm not going to waste a whole bunch of time slamming something.
Yeah, what's the point?
With the exception of, like, Baby Driver a couple years ago, which is one of my favorite reviews I ever wrote. It was only, like, three paragraphs.
You hate that movie.
I hate it. But usually I'd rather share something that I really enjoyed.
That ended up being good on your behalf, though, because Ansel Elgort got all those, like, sexual...
Yeah, well, I know obviously something was clearly off about the guy. Kevin Spacey was in that movie too. Jesus, that must have been quite a fucking scene on the set.
Dude, he was
a bunch of weirdos roaming around.
No doubt.
But I do love reviewing, I've come to enjoy, once I started writing the profiles for the Southender, I've come to admire interviewing people.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's really cool I don't want to sit down with a musician and say, "What was your favorite band?" Or like, "Who's your artist?" I'm interested in knowing that stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. But you also have to sort of, and there's some people that won't give you a lot. You have to pull stuff out of people. So you have to engage them, disarm them.
Especially musicians, man. They have walls up, you know?
Yeah, many do. And I really enjoy it. And all the credit people give me or compliment me on being a good interview, which I'm very proud of, and I appreciate that. It all comes from Howard Stern. I listened to Howard Stern my whole life. He's hands down.
Until he's sold out.
He's the best. He's the best interviewer of all time. He gets shit out of people huge celebrities that won't reveal anything about their personal lives. 20 minutes into an interview with them.
Yeah.
There's like, I'm telling stories right now. I should be telling.
I think I learned a lot from Howard Stern as well. Cause my dad would play him when I was like 10 or 11 in the car. Yeah, right. And we'd listen to you're right. A lot of musicians and a lot of, you know, just celebrities in general would not fuck with the Tonight Show or do something like that. But you know, they get on the Howard Stern show.
Well, the radio format, I mean, the show's 5 hours long, right?
Yeah,
4 to 5 hours long. So you go on the Tonight Show, you got 10 minutes.
And it's scripted,
maybe two segments if you're like fucking Eddie Murphy and you got a new movie coming out.
And you have Jimmy Fallon just like laughing in your face.
Oh, God. Right. No wonder. Like, no wonder. But Howard have an hour with these people. So
you open up, build
into it, and you get into like storytelling. That's why I like podcasting. And I'm glad you're doing this because, you know,
you can
cover a lot of ground.
Yeah, no
and
doubt.
Get in, and get into some good stuff. But I do love interviewing. I love writing. I've gotten away from it a little bit, but my plan for the Southender going into this year is to really get back to some written content
and talk
photography.
Talk to me about these short stories that you were bringing up earlier.
My goal.
I want to know about these.
My goal is a personal project. You know, how you guys cut albums, record singles.
Oh, I've never done any of that.
My goal, not only now, but you know, for the past, the past fucking 20 years, to be honest, is I want to write my own work. You know, I want to write. I'm a nonfiction writer.
As you should.
I don't really write fiction.
Yeah.
My project, my launch dream project is a collection of short stories, nonfiction from my life. I figure probably somewhere from 13 to 15 of them.
Yeah.
I've led a pretty interesting life. I've had a lot of interesting stuff happen to me. And
in the time I've known you, you've made my life more interesting.
Some of it'll be like, you know, but it's going to range from that stuff, stories about me and my sister watching MTV, to when I was, you know, going to dead shows, like some Grateful Dead related stuff, like college craziness, problems I had with women, you know, situations I had with drugs and stuff. You know, I'm very forthcoming about my past and stuff
and
like that.
That's why you're
it'll come from a humorous angle, but it's going to be heavily pop culture influenced. You know, writers like Rob Sheffield or Chuck Klosterman, some people may know, are like the pioneers of this. Like when I discovered these writers in my like 20s, I was like, this is like what I want to write. They were the first writers that said, this is what's been going through my head about how I want to write stuff. You know,
I think each
story will be named after a song title.
Ooh, that
somehow,
I like that.
Either tangentially or directly informs the story.
Yeah, because you said you kind of like in a High Fidelity, like this is kind of like you auto, you know, you lining up these songs. And
the first plan was for it to be in a sequential. The story is going to be sequentially ordered and titled after every track on Exile on Main Street.
I can't wait.
By the Stones, but I want to write 19 short stories.
Please.
So it'll probably be mixed up a little bit. When's it going to happen? I don't know. Writers procrastinate.
Yeah, like don't rush the man. It's going to be good.
Still accumulating life experience, I tell people, but I mean, I think I've accumulated
and you know
enough.
And I was going to say, I don't want to cut you off, you know, but you were saying how you're pretty open about talking about your life and drugs and your mishaps and people and relationships.
I've made a lot of mistakes to get to where I'm at today.
Haven't we all? But that's, I think that's why people gravitate towards you, man, because a lot of people don't have you know, a pedestal or a platform to talk from and to speak from.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are fuck ups and that's okay. I'm not saying like, you know, you're a fuck up, you're a loser. I'm saying a lot of people relate and like, that's why they want to hear,
my mistakes, there's a cautionary tale or there's a lesson or there's an inspiration and all these things. You keep it to yourself. There's no point. But here in Hilton Head, especially, you know, being in the hospitality industry, I work with a lot of younger people. You know, and some of them are very bright, very talented, have tremendous potential, also have a lot of problems. And I see you doing a lot of the things that I used to do. And, you know, you don't want to lecture them, but you can just try to make things relatable to people.
You're a spiritual guide for
the
lost souls.
I remember I was lecturing an employee at a Char Bar one time who cared a great deal about, like a protege of mine.
Yeah, yeah.
About how she was fucking up. And she was very intelligent, very charming, and very good at manipulating people.
Oh, that's
just
wonderful.
Like I was
when
I was that age. And I said, look, I know what you're doing. Like, and you're going down the wrong path right now.
Yeah.
And I would say, I always tell you, though, like, I have a lot of faith in you and this and that, and you have so much potential and you remind me of myself. And she's like, well, you're like, look at you. She's like, you're like the coolest guy I've ever met. I'm like, well, do you think that I wanted to manage a fucking hamburger restaurant when I was 42 years old? Do you think that was the plan? You know, look, Char Bar was cool and everything. I'm not like slamming it, but it wasn't the plan.
That's not where we fucking
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, that wasn't like all the aptitudes that I was told that I had when I was young. You know, the conclusion on the, like the, whatever the guidance counselor.
When you were writing college papers.
That would be really well suited for the Kraft hamburger business.
They were artisan burgers.
No, I mean, I wanted to fucking write for Rolling Stone. I wanted to do stuff like that. You know, I wanted to work at MTV. I've made so many mistakes that I set myself back quite a bit in life. And it's just, you know, it's always a process. Come back.
What do you call the place where, like, is it limbo? Like lost souls are like ready to cross over?
Yeah. Between the afterlife and the,
I'm pretty sure that's Cool Cats.
Cool Cats is like, that's a lot of things. I love that place, you know, but a lot of bars are like, have a limbo sort of vibe to them, you know?
Yeah, no doubt.
I think Cool Cats is too much fun to be considered like limbo. Some people would probably consider it hell. Others, perhaps heaven.
I bet there are a lot of folks. I've been there and they're living their best life.
It's been both to me many times.
You know, and here lately, it's been felt a lot like heaven to me with the trivia. That's been fun. We were just talking today about how fun
Cool Cats trivia, dude.
Yeah.
Sort of like this is a lesson in like sort of shooting your shot, you know?
Yeah.
If you feel like something's going on. You try to, you know, if you're a small business, you're trying to make as much money as you can. Everything that's happened this year, you know, obviously at the bar, we always want to do better. But people love trivia around here. Every trivia night I've gone to around here, we went to some busy ones, you know. And
we did. We won
and
some.
Had, and had a good time. And we were in there playing trivia one night. Head to head, mano a mano.
Yeah, just doing our thing.
And a bunch of people like started watching us or wanted to like
sit next to us,
wanting
in on the thing. Yeah.
And then the bar owner who had for months rejected my pitches regarding a trivia night.
The Sultan.
Yeah, Michael Takis. Was like, I think we can do that trivia thing now. I was like, good idea. So we've done four installments of it so far, man. People are coming out.
Man, and
you're a good MC, dude.
That's the thing. I'm digging it strictly because I'm a musician. People who are friends with me that are listening to this, they know I play music live. But what they don't know is like the singing part is the easy part. It's the time in between songs when I have to sit there like a doofus and say, "How's your calamari? How's you know? Yeah. How's it going?" Like I'm, you know, I'm not the best public speaker, but doing trivia and especially this recent stand-up stint was so fun. Like
I think it's I watched a lot of you guys, you know, that perform around here, and it's interesting watching you guys establish your banter. Some people are, everyone's got sort of their own thing, but there's always like a through line in certain like kind of jokes. Kyle Wareham's got some good, he's kind of like dryly funny between songs.
Kyle Wareham has a system down.
You know, Kyle, like we'll play like Freebird or something. Well, he doesn't play Freebird, but he'll play something. He'll be like,
he'll play anything.
He'll play a huge hit from yesterday and be like, I hope you guys like that one. It's an original song I just wrote.
Yeah, that's great banter. My favorite thing that he'll do
play a Disney song and say that was written by Walt Disney.
Yeah, or he'll move right in from like a crowd pleaser to an original, which is kind of cool too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the benefit of being a great songwriter is that if your originals are good enough, they come across as like they have that vibe to it. Like those songs are eminently listenable.
Yeah.
Like the first time I heard like City of the Queen, I was like, Jesus Christ, that song's a hit. Like I felt like that song would like kick down like one or two more doors, and it's going to be in the trailer for every romantic comedy that comes out. Like in
I play pretty darn songs at my gigs.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's good. It's a shout out to the homies and it's like music from the island.
Yeah. And I think it's a testament to it. And I bet sometimes people inquire about the songs. Like, what was that song?
They do. And I try not to like, I'm a speed talker sometimes in between songs. I'll be like, thank you so much. Take care of your servers and your bartenders. Like an auctioneer. Sure. But I always try to slow the pace on that one. Be like, shout out to the guys, you know, listen. But yeah, man, great songs. It's crazy that we're starting to get that from this island. One of my favorite songs, and I'm going to plug this so hard right now because I want this guy on the podcast too, but Cameron Tate has a song on SoundCloud called Feel It Best, and it's got like sub 200 plays, and it's one of the best songs I've ever heard.
Dude, he put out a song called Sin.
Yep, I remember
recently.
Sin.
I fucking loved that song the first time I heard him play it.
Yeah.
I was like, this
Vincent
is
Ruby ripping some guitar on it too.
Yeah, like Cameron Tate is really talented dude.
Yeah.
He's it's like what I call like the total package. I mean, it's like someone who promotes and books and stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
he sounds great. He writes cool songs. He looks great. Like,
and he's got a little Nate running around with him.
Yeah, he's got a little gremlin with him too.
Got a little Mogwai who plays.
Is that like
drums?
The Mandalorian is like Cameron Tate.
Yeah, Nate that's a poster.
Nate is Grogu. We smell it. Get on it, memers.
Yeah, somebody make that up, Matt.
This is so the way, Nathaniel.
you run a theater now.
Yes.
And I have been an employee of said theater.
Yeah.
Before, maybe, you know, if we would have worked together, it would have worked.
Yeah. We'll talk about theaters in general.
But I wanted to talk about, we're both huge movie guys.
Yes.
And I really wanted to talk about like movies we missed out on this year.
Yeah.
Cause that sucks.
Yeah. It's been difficult. And I've seen it from a business standpoint as someone who programs and manages the
theater. Yeah, it's actually hit home a little bit.
And you know, trying to work around and still make it work within the confines. But you know, once obviously movie theaters became deemed pretty unsafe or a risky environment to be in, every, you know, Hollywood productions were all moved a year ahead. So all these movies that were supposed to come out in 2020 are moved to 2021 at best, and continue getting moved. Like, best example I can think of, one that I'm waiting for, the Top Gun sequel, Maverick, has been rescheduled 4 times.
Where's that one at now?
July 2nd.
Okay.
And I think the most rescheduled is the new Bond movie, No Time to Die. I think it's been moved 6 times. Man,
I watched all of Daniel Craig's Bond movies, all 4 of them, in preparation to see that movie because it was supposed to drop on
like over a year ago.
Yeah, it was. Exactly.
February, I believe it was.
And I was ready to go see it.
About a year ago.
So I watched it like all 4 of them about 3 weeks out from the release of the movie.
You like Daniel Craig as Bond?
He's my favorite Bond.
He's good. I think he's the best. I think Skyfall is the best Bond film of all time.
Oh my gosh, Javier Bardem.
Yes.
Oh, I just watched a movie that I didn't give enough props the first time I saw it. I'm watching it, just watch No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
And Javier's
Friendo.
Javier Bardem's portrayal of Anton Chigurh, however you say it. I mean, what a character.
Got him an Oscar for that.
Yeah. Rightfully deserved. Although, can we talk about the Oscar nominations from that year?
Yes.
What movie is that? What year is that?
2012? I don't know. I won Best Picture.
Yeah, but that's
I believe
the thing.
It won Best Picture, Best Screenplay. He won for Best Supporting Actor.
I'm pretty sure we could argue, though, like the nominees for that year. I'm pretty sure
some years are stacked up so heavily, you know, and it's like, but sometimes we'll hear about why did so and so win this Oscar for that. And you look at the field. Sometimes the field's weak. Sometimes very strong.
Okay, Daniel Day-Lewis, Best Actor, There Will Be Blood. I feel like I can give it to him.
Yeah, well deserved.
Well deserved. Great movie. No Country for Old Men. Best Adapted Screenplay, but I just don't think... I think there was another movie that year that just had such good visuals, and I can't remember what it is offhand, but we're about to look. Where is it?
There are always certain years that critics look back on as being like seminal film years. 1994 is one of those years. That was like Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump, Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
Where just like a bunch of heavy hitters come out. And sometimes it's not even that they're blockbusters. They're just very influential. Like, see, I'm looking at you have the nominees up there on the screen, like Juno. Okay, there's a good example. Small independent film.
Yeah.
But like a new, like fresh voice, like Diablo Cody, is a very funny screenwriter. She wrote a great character in Juno and Lauren Ellen Page.
Actually, I'm not too upset with this. I think the only reason I was tripping a little bit about No Country for Old Men winning is because there will be Blood Loss, and I love Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite directors.
But it is what it is. This dude, little Boogie Nights action.
Yeah, Boogie Nights is one of the greatest film-going experiences I've had in my life, where I'm just transfixed in the theater, transported out of it, you know, not even paying attention to who the actors are or like what's going on. You buy into it completely. My mom told me as a kid that she said, I think that someone's a great actor when you don't even, they're such massive celebrities. So the bigger a celebrity are, you have to look at someone and try to disassociate the celebrity from the character. You know, so when you have someone that's like Brad Pitt or something like that, it's like, oh, that's Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
But he's also a good enough actor that it's like, now it's Cliff Booth, like Once Upon a Time.
Oh, you know, man.
Think about
being
Brad Pitt. The first, when she told me this is when I was in sixth grade, we went and saw Rain Man in theater, me and my folks. And I reviewed it for the school paper, the Jefferson Street Journal.
Wow.
So it's the first review I ever wrote.
So it does go back. You have been doing this for...
Yeah. So well, I guess that was like 1986. So I was 12.
Jeez.
33 years ago.
Hans Zimmer scored that one.
33 years ago.
Was that in your writing, the score?
I don't know if I mentioned the score.
It wasn't crazy.
I'll have to dig it up and put it up on social media.
I have a funny story about Raymond before you...
I predicted that Dustin Hoffman would win Best Actor.
Really?
I do remember that. And I said it would probably win Best Picture. And I was right about both of those.
It was so
I'm
worth
an
it.
Oscar guru.
What is he... What's the scene where he's in the bathtub and he freaks out because they're singing that Beatles song?
Yeah.
And what does he freak out saying, though? I can't remember, but he loses his shit in the
tub. He really just sort of he's hitting himself. And
yeah. My brother was asleep.
It's because he burned Tom Cruise, like when Tom Cruise was a baby. Put him in a hot bath and burned him in the water, yeah.
I was watching Rain Man and my brother was asleep.
That's what
you say,
baby
room.
burn baby.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. My brother comes out and he's like, woke up from this Dustin Hoffman, which is just great acting.
Yeah.
And he's like, he's like, what the hell is this? It woke me up. I never want to see this.
It's a great movie and a tremendous performance too.
Oh man.
But that's the first example my mother gave me of, cause I was blown away after I saw it. I'm like, I can't believe how great an actor he is. And I'd seen like Kramer versus Kramer and stuff like that. Like,
which he also won for.
Yeah. Some really good films that he had done, but the transformation is the first time I really noted like a transformation. Mm. To that extent, and it's great, man. I never gave acting a shot. I was never in theater or anything.
Man, I think we should.
I mean, I'd be interested in doing it. I'd work with you. You told me about you're interested in writing screenplays and stuff like that. I'm always down to work with you on stuff. But I mean,
and I don't think you're ever too old to get into acting. Because think about roles like, I think people have this thing in their head. They're like, oh, to be an actor, I've got to be sexy and I've got to glow on screen. I've got to look like, you know, a Skarsgård.
We're good to go then.
Exactly. But think about guys that pull off those awesome roles like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Steve Buscemi.
Exactly.
Character actors, they call them. But Philip Seymour Hoffman transcended the art of acting so much.
And I think that's
that he became a leading man. It's like you can't even this to this level of talent can't be denied. And oh, you know,
I know
it. What a fucking shame.
Yeah, what a fucking shame.
Heroin, guys, don't do it.
Yeah, don't play around with that stuff.
Yeah, seriously, it's fucked.
Talk to me about where are we at right now? Are we coming up on an hour? Got to be close, right?
I don't know. I figured you'd have a timer on.
Yeah, I should. I should probably take that into account. I think we started around like 9:10 or something.
Okay.
9:05, 9:10-ish. Who cares? We're just talking. We're having fun. But I wanted to know, like, why did it take you so long to get into stand-up comedy?
Because
you really hit it hard for the first time in the last year.
Yeah. I think I've done 6 shows.
That's awesome.
In the past year and a half. So 6 sets.
And who inspired you?
Maybe 7. No, I mean, locally, I mean, Brian Eason from Groovetown Assault is really like the driving force behind what's become the local comedy semi-movement / scene, call it what you will.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to do fundraiser for St. Jude's, which is Children's Cancer Hospital based out of Charlotte. And he sort of decided, like, I think he got to talking with Derek about it, Derek Lutaway. And they were sort of like, a bunch of our friends are pretty funny. Let's, like, see if, you know, and he approached me. He was like, would you be interested in doing, we're doing this comedy fundraiser. He's like, would you be interested in doing, like, a short set, like, 5 or 10 minutes? He said, Corey Brodsky's doing it, Derek's doing it, a couple other people, Joe Vickers.
Which most people don't think about, but someone asking you to do 5 to 10 minutes of comedy is a pretty loaded question.
yeah, but, you know, without hesitation, I was like, yeah, like, I'm in.
Yeah,
I've been a comedy fan my whole life, like you. And I think, you know, I'm humorous. I love making people laugh. It's the most rewarding feeling in the world.
Oh, my gosh. I heard a quote the other day about
comedy. The second best feeling in the world. But it really is, man. It's, you know, that's somewhat self-serving. And it's just
So, you know how, like, a lot of comedians are really great because they come from a place of struggle and that builds character, right?
Yeah.
So, I heard the other day that, like, comedians do comedy because they can control what people laugh at. And I think that's like a big thing because I think comedians are really insecure people deep down.
Yeah,
and
fucked up.
Yeah, they're all fucked up. And I think they're really worried about being on the butt end of the stick. But when you can control that medium, that's awesome. You know?
Well, they say the tried and true saying is comedy is tragedy plus time.
Yep.
and there's an element of that. And like in my comedy, you know, I think there's definitely aspects of it, but it's a great feeling. It's a high wire thing. And we've been fortunate to have people support it. And, you know, we're obviously going to continue doing it. And some great stuff's come out of it. You just did your first set, last month?
Yeah, I loved it.
At the Christmas show.
Felt
and
great.
You killed at your first time. And talk about that feeling.
Man, so it was a really weird...
Because people were curious about the comedy. Like, what's it like? Or isn't it too scary? Or how do you do it? Like,
so
go through your experience. Because it's fresh for you because you just did it for the first time.
Yeah, and a lot of people say to me, one of the biggest things I hear from my friends when I'm like, I'm doing stand-up, or I did stand-up, or they're like, I could never do that. And I'm like, that's exactly what I thought. But when I got up there, so I overthink before I do something.
Well, you told me that you wanted to be a stand-up comedian when you were fucking 16 years old.
Yeah, and I always have, and I always felt
so
like
it only took us 4 years to get you to the stage.
I know it, and it only take 10 more years for me to put on a record. Yeah. But, I loved it. And honestly, what weirded me out the most was how loose I felt up there.
Yeah.
From the second I took the microphone and twirled the wire around a little bit and just felt good and natural.
Well, you have experience on stage, which I think helps.
But that's so different, man.
It is different.
Playing music, you know, if you sing in key and you have good pitch, it's going to work.
Yeah.
Comedy, you don't know until you hear people laughing
back.
It's
getting that first laugh, man.
Oh, man. But I would say this to anybody who wants to try out comedy. It's like, write it out. Don't go up there and wing it. Unless you're fucking Dave Chappelle or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure even he writes it out.
I think it's good to have a structure. I structure my sets out, but it's getting that first laugh and it feels so good that it's like,
oh, just
I describe
it
as like, it's like boxing. It's like you land a jab.
Yeah.
And then you hit a note and then you're like, you want to keep on like, pop, 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 you know, like keep on peppering them. And it's like fucking exhilarating. It's scary,
oh
but it's
God.
Exhilarating.
Yeah. Right. And it's just, you could take chances. It's the first time in your life that you're like, people are really honed in to what I'm doing. And it's like, you know, I got a crush. There's also, there's a little bit of responsibility there too, to not waste someone's time.
Well, we benefit from, you know, we do benefit from performing for like hometown crowds. Like it's almost like people want us to succeed up there, but I mean, they won't laugh if it's not funny. Like I've had shit fall flat.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes, but you know, so I wouldn't say I haven't gone up there and killed every time. I could think about all my sets and like what bits went, what landed, what didn't, you know, it's a learning experience. But by and large, they want us to succeed and they're good, like supportive. They like comedy. Everyone loves a good comedy.
Yeah. And I've done it once and I don't by any means consider myself even an amateur at it yet,
but you're going to do it again, aren't you?
But I'm going to do it again.
Exactly.
It felt so good.
Yeah.
And you know, I definitely have stand-up comedian in my Tinder bio.
I do too. I just took mine down though.
Really? I don't
You
want
to know why? I took it down?
Never works
because
out.
Because I don't get any matches.
Well, fair enough.
I guess, you know, I'm just not, you know, I'm not sexy enough for Tinder. Tinder's, you know.
Tinder's weird.
Tinder's
man.
Like, you look
All those
good.
Things
Listen,
are weird.
You look good. That's bone. You know?
I mean, do you really
I can't get my personality across.
I know it works out for some people and there's exceptions, but like, do you really want to tell your kids, like, we met on Tinder.
I mean, is that better? That's better than saying we met at Cool Cats Lounge.
Her bio said she liked The Office and Cats. So did I. No doubt. And let's talk about this show in May. Because I'm thinking about working out 20 minutes and you want to do an hour, which is special worthy.
There's Hilton Head.
You got to hit up 4 a.m.
Culture HHI, which is an arts and culture organization, you know, slash.
Yep.
They have a. Festival of the Arts called Crescendo that they do every May, where they focus on all of the arts, you know, visual arts, music, theater, everything. And fortunately, they want to do some events at the theater. And, you know, we're going to be doing some singer-songwriter stuff there. But, I mean, our group of comedians, we like to each do a headlining show. And everyone else does short sets. Like Patrick McKee did the first one. Mm-hmm. Dolly did one, which was very successful. And I want to do mine. I want to do mine.
So it's long overdue. It's long overdue.
So I'm going to do an hour, and I want to incorporate the visual medium of the screen too, like with some old photography, and there's going to be some storytelling. It's going to be comedy, but it'll be some more like storytelling comedy, which, you know, is a certain style that, you know.
I love that stuff though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're going to laugh, you know, who knows? You'll laugh, you'll cry. But
what is Hedberg's style? Is that deadpan or what is it called? It's like real quick, just joke after joke.
Non sequiturs.
Okay.
Yeah. Like one-liners.
I like
stuff like that.
I like that
great.
Stuff, but man, for some reason, that build, that tension,
yeah.
The boiling pot is like what I love.
I like to do payoffs and like circle backs and stuff like that. I'm not good at writing one-liners. Joe Vickers is really good at writing short, like rapid fire, like
shout out Joe Vickers,
you know, hit. Yeah, so we look forward to working with him again. But I want to do this. I want to do this show, and we do like big tickets. But for this one, I want to do it. I want you to open for me. I want you to do a little set. And I want to have some music involved too. We're kicking around a couple different names, so
yeah.
I'm not going to say anything yet. But you gave me a great idea tonight about musicians to do it with, and it's going to be a great show. And hopefully, since it's during this festival, we'll get a nice crowd for it. Everything is still, of course, COVID dependent. You know, we'll see what happens. But we have the luxury at the theater of, within COVID regulations, still being able to sell 100 seats and a 200.
And 100 seats is perfect for comedy.
Yeah, and we sell a lot of them out. You know, not always, but we do. We have sold a lot of them out. People are the support is there for it. But I'm looking forward to that. I mean, it's way off down the line, but we're already start working on shit.
Yeah, I'm pumped. Well, Matt, do you have anything that you'd like to plug or talk about before we cut it? I think we're nearing up on an hour.
Yeah, so. As far as my projects, keep an eye out for the comedy announcements. It's something that we really enjoy. The South Ender Magazine online, of course. We're going to be doing some revamping this month. I want to sort of get back to some of the original scope and vision of the project, which is some stories and some local journalism. Tell some local stories. Of course, we'll talk about music. Of course, we'll talk about hamburgers, but I think there's some other shit.
We need to plug some social media, too. You're recently on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter.
Trying to build that. I'll plug it.
Yeah, it's your boy Maddie on Twitter.
It's your boy Maddie.
And I'm trying to build that up. That's tricky. But the South End of the Cligny Theater, I understand people do have reservations about attending film or events like that. We do have we're opening in limited capacity right now. We have a Way Back Wednesdays program. It's a repertory program where I pick four movies a month, and we have a different theme. You know, so in February there's
the best movies too.
Yeah, in February there's it's been hit or miss to an extent. But the more I do it, the more I'm learning what people are going to come out for.
Yeah,
at Cena Theater, we're going to be doing romantic films of all different angles in February. I'm trying to have a screening of Do the Right Thing as well for Black History Month.
Nice.
Some more comedy events, more music events, a fashion event coming up, which we'll have all the details on. So it's basically the
South
Ender.
That's Susie.
You know, Cligny Theater. Yeah, Susie will be one of the designers.
Is it Raffetto? Raffetto?
Susie Raffetto, yeah. Raffetto. And Sonia Grant from, she's the Gullah Geechee
awesome.
Shirt stuff, which
awesome.
Is very cool. And I think another designer whose name is escaping me at the moment. So that's a wrinkle that I want to get into. I've always wanted to do a fashion thing there since I started managing, and you know, John's been on board with that too. And we happen to have these friends that are very talented designers, and now I want to add an element of theater too. We haven't done any kind of live theater I want to cover everything. We do the music, we do the movies. Now I think we do the comedy.
Do it all.
Yeah, it's a great room, and I want people to check it out. It's Hilton Head's oldest theater, established in 1969.
Right.
And still, somewhat trucking.
as trucking as much as you can.
Yeah, but yeah, to follow those, and of course Swampfire Records. You know, it's a this is a collective project where, you know, the South Ender and Swampfire Records, the John and Lindsay.
Yeah, we appreciate John and Lindsay Cranford over there.
And myself now being involved with South Ender, and then us getting our hands on that room, the Kalini Theater, which has been a great collaboration. Credit to Lee Lucier and the Richardsons, of course,
For
giving us creative freedom there. They literally, I mean, they're always cool about letting us do events. They let us do whatever we want there, and we're going to keep doing cool stuff. We have a ton of announcements coming up, so I'd love it if people come out and support the theater. That's a big, big thing for us right now. I think it's important for the arts.
Well, dude, I'll plug it all. You know, I'll support the theater. You know, my friends will as well. And
dude, congratulations to you, too, for making all these movies, man.
Thank you.
Very impressive.
Well, I have to, my number one guest of all time.
I like that you're diversifying your portfolio.
We're only gonna keep these trucking.
And I love collaborating with you on anything. I'm always down to hang and work on you with stuff whenever we can, dude. I appreciate being the first guest. And thanks to everyone that listened.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Once again, that's Matty Stock. I'm Zach Stevens. And we appreciate you. And we'll see you next time. I think Matt will be pretty reoccurring on here. So
yes, I'll be back, hopefully.
Cool. See you guys. We'll be right back.